Thou who art eternal truth, truth that is reflected in the wisdom of man, we acknowledge with gratitude the labors of those who in the past, the days of small things, laid the foundations of this great university on the solid ground of sound thinking and noble living. We receive with a deep sense of responsibility the achievement of those who in recent years have brought us into this present of great opportunity. And today we pledge our loyalty and our faith to him who has been chosen to lead us into the greater possibilities of the future. Give him fidelity to the day that is past, patience and insight for the day that is present, and the spirit of prophecy to foresee the day that is to come. Amen.
Thank you. sons and daughters of the University of Rochester and friends of the University of Rochester. Of these 2 days devoted to pleasant recollections of a college life, of play and work and eager hopes, of early friendships made to last and still held dear, devoted to gratitude to college and to the men who had so much to do with the shaping of our minds and lives. This day has been set aside for the reunion of a student family. Tomorrow, Dr. Valentine is to be inaugurated as the president of the University of Rochester. Today, he receives our pledges of loyalty and support. Tomorrow, he is to receive the badge in honor of his office. Today, we meet him. We greet him with the clasp and smile of friendship. And we rejoice that he's become one of us. Dr. Valentine is eager to know the graduate body. He seeks our support and our loyalty. He seeks to add to our pride in our university and to make that university justify our pride. Among his hopes of accomplishment is to make the student body one of increasing mental and moral excellence. And for this, he relies upon the worth and work of the faculty and upon the enthusiasm and cooperation of the graduate body. A splendidly equipped plant, efficient machinery, skilled operators have been provided. We can help to furnish a raw material of increasing excellence. The fame of the plant and of its management will depend upon the superiority rather than Frank Kelly or his office. Dr. Valentine comes to fill a place made vacant by the resignation of a man who made the University of Rochester an outstanding feature upon the intellectual map of the world. A place made conspicuous by the success of his predecessor. A place filled with possibilities for future, continued, and greater success. When it became apparent that Dr. Rees must leave, the question which troubled those who had the interests of the University of Rochester at heart was who can take his place in such a university, full of life and rational expectations, just entering upon the midsummer of its career, with the curve of its progress rising ever more abruptly. A university to which the future holds out both hands, filled with promise and splendid assurance. The search for a worthy successor led to all the places where intelligence, character, and leadership might be thought to abide, either recognized or in hiding. And the man was found, a man in love with life, with a clear head, tact, affability, personality, leadership, a man with a capacity for doing things without making enemies. A man with a sense of humor and a capacity for laughter. A man with the fervor and enthusiasm of youth and the wisdom of ripened years. A man who, in the morning of life, had leaped to a prominence in a field where prominence is usually deferred for older men. The selection was made with the confidence that all would be well. A man had been found to whom nature had been kind and generous, and who'd shown his gratitude for generous gifts by early and distinguished accomplishments. The inauguration of Dr. Valentine is an occasion for self-congratulation, for acknowledging our debt to Dr. Reed, and for pledging our support to his success. An occasion for feeling pride in the past, gratitude for our present good fortune, and confidence in the future. Our interest in this university and our desires for its make us all the legatees of Dr. Reed. And our debt to him will continue to grow as we continuously reap the results of his labor. And the debt which stands out most clearly just now is that he made the university such that Dr. Valentine was induced to come. It must be a pleasant thing for Dr. East, in the sunny afternoon of life, to bask in the contemplations and reflections of the past. To remember the struggles and the labors which once distressed him, only as the occasions which tried his worth and permitted him to show his mettle, which permit him now to recall in pleasant retrospection his success and remember with pleasure all of those things which once caused him distress. Dr. Reed made the university worthy of its students. Perhaps one of Dr. Valentine's tasks will be to find students worthy of the university. We who are older feel and have felt an increasing pride that we are graduates of the university. Some of us entered a college just emerging from a mantle of obscurity, sucked in at most the edges. Since then and for many years, we have mentioned our alma mater with mounting pride and satisfaction. Rochester has had but four presidents. Anderson nourished it in its infancy. Hill brought it to adolescence. Reese gave it maturity and endowed it with power for accomplishment. Dr. Valentine will see to it that the vigor and the powers of maturity are so employed as to realize the expectations, the hopes, the dreams of those who labored in the past. We want Dr. Valentine to realize that the joy which lies in our welcome foretells the sincerity of our future friendship. We want him to know that the esteem, and the respect, and the affection which we hold for his predecessors, we stand ready to give to him. We want him to permit us to share in that small part of his work which circumstances make possible, And do not compel him to share with others.
You are listening to Mr. Percy D. Obiot, president of the Associated Alumni of the University of Rochester, speaking at the exercises of welcome to President-elect Alan Ballantyne. We shall resume the broadcasting of these exercises from the Eastman Theater at 10:45.
It is significant that the student body should be accorded a prominent part in the ceremonies inaugurating a new era in the life of the University of Rochester. Their participation serves to emphasize the increasingly important place of the students in the structure and development of this university. For upon the undergraduate attitude toward the ideals, plans, and actions of the university, and equally upon the attitude of the university toward its students, depends the weight of the influence of the University of Rochester upon higher education. This university is an effective agent for the betterment of society, and it will be known and judged primarily by the intellectual accomplishment, collective and individual, of its graduates. The attitudes of the faculty and of the student body as to what constitutes real, solid educational value will naturally differ because of the different viewpoints from which they are drawn. We have reached a stage in the development of this university where it would seem wise to make an attempt to harmonize these different views, to focus their attendant actions upon some definite educational objective. Under President Rush Reese, the University of Rochester made tremendous forward strides, intellectually as well as physically. Since the completion of our new buildings, we've had a short breathing spell in which to gather our strength and purpose for our new progressive movement. We now have, to guide our forward steps, a new leader, in whom we of the student body have unbounded confidence. The task of attempting to analyze and in some measure express our personal feeling toward our new president is extremely difficult because there are so many things to express and so many ways of expressing them, and yet none of them seems adequate. To say that we are delighted with him is putting it too mildly. He has completely captivated us.
Like his buoyant youth, because in it we see in him a kindred spirit. We feel that his interest in us is deep and sincere. He's interested in us not because we are so many guinea pigs in an intellectual laboratory, but because we are individuals. We feel that he understands and sympathizes with student problems as we see them. Consequently, his coming has awakened in the student body a new and active interest in the plans and policies of this university, and has given birth to many new student thoughts concerning this. A surface examination of the desires and ideas of the various colleges, departments, groups, and individuals comprising the student body leads one to believe that there are wide differences in opinion as to what is good and what is bad, what should be retained and what rejected about the University of Rochester. However, under these differences of opinion flows one strong current of which these various superfluous desires are merely offshoots. That current is the burning desire for progress. Progress first of a broadly cultural and intellectual nature. The more thoughtful members of the student body realize that regardless of what the aim in life of the individual university student may be, whether it be satisfaction with oneself, honor in the eyes of one's neighbors, or the power to rule over one's fellow men, the world to which we all aspire will permit us to reach our goal only if it finds us capable of some form of intellectual or cultural attainment. Therefore, we hope for the greatest progress in the University of Rochester and a more complete and concerted effort to awaken in each student a scholarly attitude toward education as a whole. As a further progressive step, we would like to see a gradual slowing of our highly geared, rapidly revolving collegiate educational system, permitting deeper investigation into fields in which the individual is interested. Without it being necessary for such a student to abandon in his search most of what the university offers of social life. The students feel that social life is of great importance, the intellectual man who would convey his thoughts to others. However, it is not necessary for the administration of the university to spend valuable time conceiving plans for a more complete social life for their students. All the students ask is the maintenance of a tolerant and sympathetic attitude toward what may seem to older and wiser heads to be the institutions of impulsive youth, what may appear to the students to be invaluable experiences. We of the student body feel that the University of Rochester has all the tools in its grasp with which it can become a truly great educational institution, a growing and improving student body, unsurpassed physical equipment, freedom from financial handicaps, and the reputation for doing well whatever it has undertaken. It remains only for an inspired leader to combine these attributes and, using them each to its best advantage, lead the university toward a definite educational objective. And so, to Alan Valentine, we of the student body look for active, vigorous, progressive leadership toward what we sincerely believe to be the destiny of the University of Rochester, a place among the leaders in intellectual attainment in any educational field that it so chooses to enter, and the ultimate realization of any other worthy goal toward which it so earnestly bend its efforts. Thank you.
The proof of our esteem and of our confidence in you is this. We are going to tell you the truth about ourselves as freely as we would tell one another. There is no greater evidence of hospitality or proof of confidence than that we should consistently refuse to put our best foot forward in our dealings with you. The quality of the welcome which the stranger receives does not depend upon the size of the guest house, nor the luxury of its appointment, nor can it be measured by the words of courtesy which the host speaks. Even the variety of the entertainment which the host provides may be misleading. The true welcome to one who comes from a distant place lies in the extent to which his hosts reveal themselves to him, their inner selves, their scales of value, the goals which they think worthwhile. By lifting the veil of the inner sanctuary of the heart and mind, the stranger can be given the sense of that oneness with those who receive him within their gates. So, Alan Valentine, I, upon whom the responsible task has fallen of speaking for the different faculties of the University of Rochester, propose to prove that the welcome of these faculties is of highest quality by stating in order the values which each college considers of great significance. To do the task I have undertaken in an adequate way, I would need as many hours at my disposal as I have minutes. My presentation of our scale of values at the University of Rochester may resemble a mere listing of objectives, but I am given confidence that I am speaking to an educator on behalf of educators. In such company, to belabor the statement of an educational goal is not necessary. In presenting the hopes and aims of the faculties of the different colleges, it has seemed best to reverse the chronological order of their founding. At the conclusion, I shall have a word to say on a subject which I think is of common interest to all the university faculty: the School of Medicine and Dentistry. The significant characteristic of the School of Medicine and Dentistry of the University of Rochester is the close relation which exists between the teaching of medicine and the work of the hospital, including the Strong Memorial and the Municipal Hospital. As Dean Whipple has expressed it, it is impossible to see where the School of Medicine leaves off and the hospitals to give. The instruction in the medical school might be called the direct method, in that there is a minimum of formal classroom instruction and a maximum of laboratory and clinical training. The advantages of this method of teaching are threefold. First, the curiosity of the student is aroused by direct contact with the unsolved problems of the research laboratory and of the clinic. Second, by working in the laboratory and hospital, the student is encouraged to satisfy his own curiosity. Third, he learns by doing. That is, he develops a technique of research through the use of which the fundamentals of his branch of science become a part of himself. This is the fundamental pedagogy of the medical college, and one in which its faculty and students have confidence. There are certain implications of this direct method of teaching which has to be faced by the faculty and administrative officers of our School of Medicine. First, by the very nature, it is and must be expensive. Again, this form of instruction places a limit upon the number of students who can be received into the medical college. With the present personnel and equipment, no entering class can well be larger than 50. In fact, it has been discovered that a total registration for 4 years based upon an entering class of 45 is likely to tax the facilities of instruction to full capacity. There is yet another important implication of this direct method of instruction. If the medical students are to be allowed direct access to the research work of the medical school, it is highly important that the teachers with whom they come in contact are themselves exceptionally well equipped for research and are enthusiastic about it. To accomplish this most necessary end, it is essential that each professor shall have adequate time to carry out his own research program. The School of Medicine and Dentistry has attempted to meet this need by setting the various teachers of medical subjects free for approximately one half of their time to carry on their research. The contribution, therefore, of our School of Medicine is of a threefold nature. The giving of what we consider to be exceptionally fine training to the future physicians and surgeons. Second, cooperation with the other hospitals of the city in caring for the sick and the injured. And third, the broad social contribution of discoveries of pure and applied science. We believe that these contributions justify the method. We have every reason to expect that this form of organization for instruction, for research, and for relief will increasingly justify itself as the years go by. In one aspect of its work, the School of Medicine and Dentistry is unique. I know of no other school of medicine which has associated with it, as a part of its plan, a municipal hospital. The services which the School of Medicine renders to the city should not be measured in money. But even on the basis of financial measurement, the city could not receive as great value from any other arrangement. But the School of Medicine also benefits, as has been pointed out, by having a municipal hospital as a part of its general plan. The existence of a municipal hospital in juxtaposition to the Strong Memorial Hospital and the School of Medicine and Dentistry is yet another evidence of the way in which the university has profited by the cordial cooperation of the city of Rochester. It is just as true that the service which is rendered to the city by this particular school of the university is one way in which a part of her debt to the city is paid. The Eastman School of Music, which acquired its distinctive individuality and began its work in the year 1921, has moved steadily forward to an outstanding position among the schools of music in this country. During this remarkable development of a decade and a half, the faculty of the school has aimed at certain definite goals. In general, it may be said that the Eastman School of Music, like the School of Medicine and Dentistry, has not sought to become a large institution. It is the quality of musical education, rather than the number of persons taught, which has engaged the attention of the members of its faculty and administration. A distinction should be drawn between the studio conservatory type of school and the university school of music. Most of the foreign conservatories and majority of the older schools of music in this country are of the studio conservatory type, the aim of which is to develop concert musicians. from a number of those who are specifically trained to become distinguished as performers, it is hoped that a considerable number may develop into virtuosi. To achieve this objective, the emphasis in teaching is placed largely upon private instruction. In the Studio Conservatory School of Music, a minimum of attention is paid to broad musical scholarship and to general education. Because so much of the student's work is under one or two individuals in the Studio Conservatory type of school, he is not conscious of the organized effort and the collective responsibility of the entire faculty for his education. In contrast to the Studio Conservatory objective, Eastman School is standing more and more for a broad general education in theory, in composition, in choral and orchestral training, in the history of music and its appreciation and interpretation. Aside from subjects purely musical, training in the English language, in some modern language, in European history, in physical education, and in some instances in the history and principles of education is required, as well as the securing of the technique necessary for the development of the student's abilities as a performer. The preparation which the Eastman School of Music is giving to the individual student fits him for a life work in the field of his major interest, even though he does not succeed in becoming a virtuoso or a concert performer. The faculty of the School of Music believe, rightfully, that the kind of education which it is giving to its students is the only kind suitable in a university such as Rochester. It is persuaded, as I am, that the emphasis in its development, therefore, should be placed upon the training of students who are interested in fulfilling the broad requirements for the degree. The number of degree students has increased from the day of its founding to about 400, which is the maximum number which can be accommodated. The number of students who have secured a certificate of proficiency in a field narrower than the demand for the degree has decreased to almost zero. The proof that a broad general training in the Eastman School of Music is fulfilling a social as well as a vocational need can be found in the analysis of the fields of employment entered by the members of the graduating class of 1934. 31% entered the public school system in some capacity as teachers, generally of music. 11% became private teachers. 14% continued their work as students. 9% became teachers of music in colleges. 3% entered business. 1% entered religious work. 16% of the women students were married. Only 6% became what the school calls professional, that is, concert performers. In other years, this percentage of professionals was a good deal higher. It's only fair to say that 11%, as far as we know, are still unemployed. This diversity of employment does bear out the claim that the graduates of the Eastman School of Music have broad training for diversified forms of service. As the faculty of the School of Music looks to the future, it hopes to continue the American Composers Concert and the publication of American music. In my judgment, it is impossible to measure the significance of the encouragement and backing which young American composers have received through the interest and efforts of the Eastman School. We hope that this may continue to be a part of their program. When the history of the development of American music comes to be written, may it not be true that the contribution which the Eastman School of Music has made and will continue to make, not only to American music, but through it to the world of music, will be adjudged as an outstanding and distinguished service. We are a young nation and are still pioneering in the field of the arts. That America has a contribution to make to the world of music, no one can doubt. The development of a confidence and a pride in the future of American music is an important and valuable service which our faculty of the Eastman School might well cherish as a permanent objective. We'll now turn our attention to the College of Arts and Science. I think most of you realize that the College of Arts and Science is made up of the two coordinate colleges, the College for Women and the College for Men. It is more difficult to state the aims and purposes of a liberal arts college than it is those of a technical or professional school. Less than a year ago, however, our faculty framed such a statement, a part of which I cannot do better than quote. The aim of the undergraduate college is the cultural development of the individual student. This cultural development may be recognized in the individual student by his possession of certain powers and attitudes. First, an awakened curiosity and the mastery of a technique of logical thinking which enables him to satisfy this curiosity. Second, the powers of reflection, by the aid of which he is able to observe and to classify the facts and experiences of life, and by the exercise of trained judgment to keep them in proper perspective, to be there for so the student might work out his own philosophy of life. Three, the ability to respond to and receive inspiration from the beautiful and worthwhile experiences of life. Four, the realization that his full cultural development must be achieved not by withdrawal from society, but by participation in the social life of his community. This condensed statement of the aim of the College of Arts and Science was expressed after the faculty had undertaken, at least in part, to put it into effect. The curriculum was revised so that it might be more adaptable to the needs of the individual student. The first 2 years of our four-year college course are spent in laying the broad foundation of the student's education. The last 2 years are given over to the development of the student's major interest, whether vocational or avocational. A definite effort is made during the earlier years to arouse his curiosity and develop his powers of reflection, to make him responsive to the significant experiences of life, and to press upon him the fact that he is a member of society, meet certain social obligations. During the junior and senior years, 6 courses out of 10 are generally in the field of the student's major interest. At the end of the senior year, each student is required to pass a comprehensive examination, the underlying philosophy of which is educationally significant. It is to test not so much the student's power in acquiring facts, but rather his ability to reflect upon the facts. It is an endeavor to lead the student to overleap the barriers which have, for so many years, tended to keep him from passing freely from one field of thought to another. If he is a student of physics, we hope that his interest in metaphysics or mathematics and mathematics may be developed. If he's a student of philosophy, we hope his mind may be directed to pass without restraint from the general to the specific, that is, from reflection on philosophy to psychology, to history, to sociology, to religion, to economics, to the natural and physical science. In this difficult problem of teaching the student to reflect, we count not ourselves to have arrived. Some progress has been made. We are beginning to see that to prepare students for the comprehensive examination, there is need of teachers with broad and varied interests, whose laboratories are the whole world of human action. Even partial success in the development of the reflective mind will have justified us as members of the great profession. Mr. President-elect, this attempt to break down the barriers between the departments does not mean that the advantages of specialization will be lost. It means that the evils of narrow specialization will be removed. We believe that the conclusions of our educational philosophy are in line with the demands of society. For college and professional graduates of today, to be specialists and nothing else is to be cramped and hampered in the making of a satisfactory contribution to human welfare. Our School of Medicine asks for men trained in pre-medical subjects, it is true, but is asked for much more, namely that there be a breadth and a depth to their interests, which will make them at home in any community. I have been assured by one of our most distinguished medical practitioners that today no doctor dare be too narrow, even in his chosen field, that today there is an increasing demand for the well-qualified general practitioner. We have already indicated how the faculty of the Eastern School of Music feels about this matter of too narrow specialization. In industrial engineering and in business, the demands for trained men are changing from day to day as machines take the place of men. As the frontiers of our learned profession, of our industrial life, of our political institutions change, so must the students whom we train for leadership be men and women who, by virtue of their developed powers of reflection, are able to change and to meet change without fear, without despair, but with courage and wisdom, must they be able to meet the needs of the new day. The faculty of the undergraduate college has discovered that it is hopeless to attempt to improve the quality of the student's thinking as long as he is overburdened by the quantity of work to be done. Originality and initiative in the realms of reflection can come only to that student who is not constantly submerged by a multiplicity of assigned readings, term papers, and various forms of tests. A study has recently been made of what we have called student load. Its results lead us to believe that the quality of the student's work has been impaired by the quantity of the work demanded of him. It is simple enough to reduce the burden of assignment, but quite a different matter, and much more difficult, to know how to acquire higher quality of thinking and more perfect methods of expression. Having stated what I believe to be the conviction of the faculty of the College of Arts and Science with reference to the necessity of a broad and liberal education, I turn now for a moment to what might appear to some as a contradiction of our general policy, namely the effort to adapt our teaching to meet a vocational need in the women's college. We believe that our curriculum should contain courses which are both vocationally and culturally suited to the particular needs of our women students. A beginning has recently been made in this direction by reestablishing a department of sociology. This has been cordially received by the students of both colleges. Many students have registered for courses in sociology because of their cultural value. Others are interested in them because they plan to enter some form of social service. Until recently, comparatively few of our women students had considered social work as a possible career. In the formulation of what is known throughout the university as the 10-year plan, the faculty of the undergraduate colleges committed itself to a further development of graduate instruction and research work. A variety of reasons have led us to this decision. Graduate instruction and research work must go hand in hand. Neither one can be at its best without the other. Yet each is an adequate and desirable end in itself and should be so judged. The undergraduate is our first responsibility of the college faculty. In the interest of the undergraduate, we believe that the development of graduate instruction and research is essential. By contact with a research scholar, the undergraduate comes to know what scientific curiosity is. He learns techniques, the handmaiden of science. He seeks at first hand the price man is willing to pay to push back even a little the frontiers of ignorance. If the student receives even dimly the vision of the glorious adventure of the search of knowledge, he can no longer be a time server in learning. There is another reason why we believe there must be a place for research in a good undergraduate college. To recruit our faculty with active and stimulating teachers, we naturally turn first to those who have problems to solve, who are research scholars. Such men or women will not join a university where their studies cannot go forward. If the College of Arts and Science wishes scholars on its staff, it must offer to them that form of hospitality which scholars care about, that is, the time and the facilities to seek the answers to their own questions. Before closing this description of the aims and purposes of the different colleges, I should like to mention one objective which I believe is of common interest to all the faculty, namely that of adapting and, if necessary, increasing the offerings of the university through the university extension or through other channels to the adults of the Rochester community. Something is being done to give instruction to adults, much of it almost single-handed by the extension department, of course, with the cooperation of the different departments. Which important division of university work has not had the encouragement and backing which I believe it deserves? We are not in a position to find fault with the public's lack of interest in ideas and learning if we are not prepared to make sacrifices to give the adults of our community opportunities to keep themselves alive intellectually. This should be a recognized function of every university. Mr. President-elect, you will observe that there are two stated aims of each college, and these are identical. First, to give the students the best instruction within its power. Second, to limit the number of students in each college to that maximum which is commensurate with the highest qualities of instruction. In making these statements about ourselves, We are far from being complacent and self-satisfied. We confess frankly that we shall be constantly in need of your help and your guidance. We must rest assured, you must rest assured of our support and enthusiastic cooperation in making our university what we should all like to see it become. In welcoming you on behalf of the faculties of the different schools and colleges of this university, we at the same time congratulate ourselves on your coming to us as
Madam and Mr. Chairman, and well, members, graduates, and friends of the university. The trustees of this university have done me great honor. Only time can determine the quality of their judgment. For the moment, we can but recognize their daring and share their hope. Aware of the responsibilities to be faced, I take courage in the sympathy of the faculty present here. They are strange faculty if they do not believe themselves well qualified to shape the educational policies of this university. With that belief, I am sympathetic. Whatever decisions in educational matters are made here, I hope will be reached with the approval of its teaching staff. Many speeches have been made upon the subject of education without notable results. I am reluctant to add to their number, but this ceremony places me under an obligation which I cannot in fairness ignore. It is easier to state problems than to pronounce their solutions, for the latter can be reached only from our mutual experience. My remarks are concerned chiefly with undergraduate education, for undergraduates are the heart of a university. From them come its general standards and its social tone. Undergraduate problems are thus of concern to the graduate school, whose standards and whose students emerge partly from our colleges. 35 years ago, this university, with singular good judgment, inaugurated as its new president, Dr. Rush Reed. On that occasion, the presidents of Columbia, Chicago, and Smith College made addresses. Each was justified in speaking at impressive length, for each had clearly in mind a vision of the ideal university. If Presidents Seth Lowe and Popper and Seeley were here today, they would be encouraged by the advances made toward their ideal. The quality more than the methods of our progress would impress them. They would be optimistic, as we are, for the future of higher education. Because we are optimists, because we see fine things in the present and future of universities, this may be a proper time to glance realistically at the unfinished business before us. Those three presidents would sadly tell us that their hopes of 35 years ago had not been fully realized. They would warn us that we are too optimistic, that large endowments, even when coupled with energy and wisdom, cannot build a great university in a few decades. They would try to guard us against expecting too much, reminding us that the greatest universities represent the effort and wisdom of several centuries. They would remind us that in spite of impressive individual achievements, education in the minds of most Americans still means an uncomfortable discipline happily outgrown with youth. We know that education should mean much more than this. We know that in spite of the efforts of innumerable teachers, much shallow thinking remains. Though thousands of graduates are men of whom their colleges are justly proud, there are great numbers upon whom education seems to have left no deep mark. Men who desert the standards of thought and progress to which they swore allegiance during college days. Such graduates often regret that college education, as distinguished from college life, has left so light a stamp upon them. The truth is that college viewed in retrospect will mean to any graduate what it meant in undergraduate days. The aspects of college that drew forth his energy then are naturally those that win his devotion now. If during college life he thought chiefly in terms of athletics and social life, to those things chiefly will he return as an alumnus, and by his collective pressure perpetuate the sophomoric spirit, wrongly dignified by the word collegiate. To him, the trappings of college life still mean college. Through them, he developed his energy and ability. Can it be wondered that he later turns those qualities to the support of the externals of college life, rather than to an understanding of its academic effort? Had his teachers found a way to make him quicken to their enthusiasm, college would appear to him now in a far different light. It would seem to him, as it seems to many graduates who are here today, an important milestone in the intellectual development of a lifetime. It is the obligation of universities to see that all their graduates think of college in terms of the intellectual maturity they receive there. To achieve this, education must be made a more effective rival to the charms of organized play. There are things in education which can be made to appeal to youthful energy, even to offer the charms of activity. The very meaning of the word activity in student life is significant. It means something extracurricular and hence attractive. It means anything except the chief purpose of college life. The conscious training of the intellect is not, in the student mind, an activity. As a result, we see a promising student adopt under social pressure the casual standards of his associates, to his own loss and theirs. We sometimes see the discouraged professor hiding behind a comfortable pose of mild cynicism, which saps the energy of his thought and lessens the reality of his teaching. Public opinion has assessed these facts and drawn its conclusions, often expressing a lack of confidence in the fruits of the classroom. It questions the wisdom of the professor in fields outside his own and prefers the judgment of a man of practical experience. It regards higher education as vaguely desirable, but does not consider it essential for leadership in public or private affairs. These convictions cannot be ignored or disproved by a single lecture. Our universities can provide the complete answer to their critics only when they produce graduates who are themselves an answer. Graduates who know that college did make later life more interesting and more useful, that college did instill permanent standards of thought and good taste, standards which the Renaissance sought in the perfect courtier and modern life in the gentleman and scholar. Part of the goal of education remains that of the old phrase, manners maketh man, for by a man's way of life is his education judged. The Chaucers and Raleighs and Sidneys are too few today, men who could pass with ease from the study to the forum, equally effective in thought and in action. Too seldom does our education produce a Dwight Morrow or a Chief Justice Holmes. No university can forget its obligation to produce men like these, men naturally inclining to business or public life, who enrich those fields with the rightness of thought derived from college days. Nor can it neglect the man destined to intellectual things, who should have learned in college to pursue them with vigor and charm in an active society. Men of both types must have learned always to think in terms of excellence, not of mass or profit, to be dissatisfied with a second rate, even when they can for the moment achieve no better, to refuse all possible compromise of means and all compromise of aims. To produce graduates like these, a university must act upon the courageous assumption that each student comes to college to give the best that is in him. It must not excuse in any student or any teacher effort short of his best. It must maintain that the average student can and will perform with something better than mediocrity. If the university is not entitled to make these assumptions, How else can it fulfill its purpose? It cannot avoid the issues, for there are no longer monasteries to retire to or ivory towers in which to hide. The excuse that scholarship is not concerned with the daily life of ordinary men has been worn threadbare. All education must, directly or indirectly, concern itself with the adjustment of human life. The marketplace, the laboratory, the museum, the town hall, all make their contributions to the university and merit its contribution in return. The aim of education is not to provide factual knowledge, but a mature point of view. A man's opinions when he graduates are less important than the process by which he reaches them. To be able to form an opinion free from prejudice, propaganda, or influence is inward freedom of thought and the true object of education. If the student's opinions are a mixture of prejudices, of borrowed credos, or of beliefs absorbed on the authority of an instructor, his mind is not free, and he has failed to achieve education. If he is satisfied to express convictions based upon crude logic, limited observation, or superficial study, he has misused the aim of college, for his mind is still in bondage to the minds of others. College students and others do not always realize the shame of such mental slavery, and the excitement and danger of mental freedom, of exploring the unknown countries that lie before the perilous art of thought. If they did, the library and the laboratory would rival the gymnasium and the fraternity house. To arouse their students to the excitement of intellectual things has been the conscious aim of universities ever since the days of Erasmus and Galileo. But our American colleges have been less successful in that effort than their European counterparts. In the older culture of Europe, there has been developed, even among people with few talents or opportunities, a respect for fine thinking. Most continental students enter a university ready to achieve some profound intellectual experience. They realize the main purpose of the university and recognize that its opportunity can be theirs but once. They know that they must pay dearly in money, time, and effort, and they demand real knowledge in return. Usually, they strike a far shrewder bargain than our own undergraduates, who pay half the price of an education and often take less than half an education in exchange. In America, the conditions of our growth have not equally emphasized intellectual things. The conquest of a new country has brought an admiration for the practical at some cost to the intellectual. This physical conquest is nearly at an end, but there remains an American restlessness, bred of the discrepancy between the ideals we have inherited and the manner of life we have adopted. We have created a new leisure and a new luxury, but until as a nation we can think clearly and dispassionately, we cannot solve the problems that conquest of nature has presented. We are the unlucky generation to whom school and college and experience have granted only mental agility, when clear thinking was never more needed. Under such circumstances, the spark of education rarely bursts into flame, and teachers are too often satisfied with a few flickers of light amid clouds of heavy smoke. These conditions cannot be changed overnight, even by a new president whose reach exceeds his grasp. The problem of improving them is perennial. We cannot alter facts, but we can slowly alter points of view, remembering that to undergraduates, the custom of 3 years standing has become a tradition. American youth has so far shown the energy to strike hard for what it really desires. If we can strengthen its desire for intellectual power, youth will soon set the pace for its educators. What can we do to make education more effective? The disappointment of professor and student have often been due to the points of view with which they approach their mutual task. The American background has made teachers and students a little on the defensive, afraid of being called highbrow if they show open devotion to the scholarly ideal. College, home, and society have not, separately or together, created a point of view wholly receptive to the process of higher education. Such a point of view is one that would recognize no change in objectives between academic work and collegiate and general life. This is rarely the case with college students, who are the victims of divided loyalty. The classroom sets one group of interests, one way of life. The campus sets another. The student of science or mathematics finds in them an ideal of precise, modest, logical pursuit of an uncertain goal. But the same student sees in campus life the success of the astutely practical opportunist. The student of the humanities may gain a glimpse of the scholarly ideal, of the thrill of bringing both reason and imagination to bear upon an abstraction. But when the same student turns to the life of the campus, he finds its values to lie in personality and highly concrete talent. If he seeks success in both places, he must change like a chameleon each time he passes through the classroom door. He is torn between divided loyalties and suffers from the uncertainty of aim that results. No one can work effectively or happily if he must reconcile the demands of two diverse philosophies within him. Not until the lives of students in their homes, on the campus, and the streets can be brought into greater sympathy with lecture hall and laboratory can our educational system become highly efficient. Not until the average student ceases to have one point of view for his professors and another for his friends will this great waste of effort end. The philosophy a student derives from his hours outside the classroom can help or ruin the quality of his work within it. In the effort to make student life and aims consistent, most universities have contributed to externals, establishing high standards of food, lodging, and health. But this neglects many of the influences which determine a student's attitude toward his own education. A few universities are doing their best to set a mature tone throughout undergraduate life. Such efforts have already yielded remarkable results. But no university has yet been able to assess every phenomenon of college life and encourage or discard each according to its influence upon maturity of thought. Since our colleges cannot find instinct in American life a wholly receptive attitude toward higher education, they must create that attitude. Sooner or later, they must determine what, for their purposes, should be selected from American life to be encouraged and what to be discarded. The university that does so may find itself opposing some of those aspects of college life which still remain most colorful and popular. But if a university is to ask its students to show their maturity, it must declare its own. I do not suggest an increased regimentation of student life. On the contrary, it is likely that our colleges must in time either discard schoolboy regulations or the schoolboys who have made them necessary. I do suggest that colleges reconsider each separate phase of college life and, regardless of its present prestige, determine whether on the whole it helps or hinders an intellectually receptive point of view. In such a study, students should share, for under the present system, theirs is the greatest loss. No phase of life or interest on the campus should go unquestioned, for each plays its part in creating a point of view. Every student activity supported or tolerated by the college should come under scrutiny. So too with the influence of the professor outside the classroom, and the influence of the kind of publicity that magnifies trivial things to an inflated importance. Surveyed in this light, a college might find that its whole social life had developed casually into a traditional mold by undergraduates unaware of its implications. It might find that its curriculum and methods of instruction fail to provide for natural emotions and energy, which hence have turned to less useful outlets. It might discover that the actual conduct of fraternity life, such standards more harmful than helpful to the university ideal. It might find that the public, the press, and the accountant's report have shaped intercollegiate athletics into a hard and harmful mold, without regard to the interests of undergraduates whom athletics should serve. Perhaps such a study would disclose that in some ways the faculty weakens the very conceptions it has labored with infinite care to create. No matter how dear a project, if it proved ineffective by this test, it would be over or discarded. This is errant idealism. But most universities, including our own, have already begun to apply it. There are signs that American education is throwing off its leading strings. Like our nation, it is settling down again to serious work. Our own colleges cannot afford merely to follow where the more courageous lead. The university that succeeds in such a program would meet the only valid criticisms that can be advanced against it. Education would function with less weight. Graduates could face with confidence the tests to which both the world of intellect and the world of action would subject them. They would then possess a unity of aim, which would bring the quality of their thinking to bear upon every aspect of their lives. Not to do so would seem to them a travesty of education, worthy the irony of a Swift or a Voltaire. This is the ideal every university has always set for itself. I have only tried to phrase it anew, and to suggest one way by which we may draw nearer to it. The approach by any road depends upon our confidence in ourselves and in our students. The young men and women who come to our colleges today are worth our confidence. In our demands upon them, we can show that we believe in their intelligence, that we assume their capacity and willingness to meet more exacting standards. Undergraduates will do what is expected of them, if that expectation is made clear and continuous to every agency which the university can bring to bear. To make effective use of all those energies is our immediate problem. We should affirm, too, our belief in ourselves, our confidence that the work we are doing is in importance second to none, our conviction that our aims are wise and not to be abandoned at the sound of public clamor. We should affirm our conviction that the discordant elements in college life must be brought into unity in the mind of the student. Such affirmation, bravely maintained, will in time set their stamp upon the whole fabric of American life.